You're listening to the Hello World Podcast, number 74. My name is Sean Wildermuth, and I'm your host. The Hello World Podcast is where you can hear from some of your favorite developers, authors, and speakers about how they got started in this business and the decisions they made along the way. We go way back to their first computer, their first code experience, and their first job. We've decided not to have a sponsor for the podcast, but if you want to support the podcast and the kinds of things that I do, feel free to visit my Pluralsight courses at seanw.me/psauthor, including my newest course on building a web app with ASP.NET Core. On this week's show, we have Atlee Hunter. We recorded this episode live in front of an audience during the Hello World road trip. Atlee was under the weather that day, so you might notice some oddities about his voice. But I think his story is important, and you can see beyond the gravel in his voice. Atlee Hunter is a passionate developer with over 20 years' experience. As one of the most prolific modern UI developers in the world, he has hundreds of unique apps running on millions of Windows devices worldwide. A Microsoft Windows Platform MVP and a Telerik MVP and Insider, he is constantly working with developers worldwide to improve both skills and the platforms themselves. Atlee is always sharing his knowledge and connecting with developers through events, his blog, email, Twitter, Skype, and LinkedIn. I first ran into Atlee way back when I was doing a lot of Windows Phone development. On today's show, you'll hear Atlee's experience starting in software development and how he got to the point where he's this passionate about building apps, especially on the Windows platform. Let's take a listen. Welcome, Toronto. So far, I haven't used the wrong city name, or at least I've been good about editing that out of the actual recordings. So today I wanted to introduce Atlee Hunter, who we've known each other since mostly the Windows Phone days, is I think the first time we met.
Yeah, I think around 2010.
And you were the guy that you had built like 34 apps in 3 seconds or something? Is that?
No, I think I wrote 40 apps in a week.
Yeah.
At that point, yeah.
That's about, isn't that what I said? And that's how I kind of knew you. You were just pumping out apps. It was really impressive. And I remember one of the apps was about being able to add some things to the home screen, like turning on or off your airport mode or something like that.
All
that
the was things sort of Microsoft forgot when I put the phone together.
Exactly. So did you grow up with programming or computer, or is this something that come up later? Or?
Well, in high school, I got interested in programming computers, and because I'm a dinosaur, our high school actually had punch card systems, so that's what
punch
I started.
Punch card. Yeah. You do not look old enough to have punch cards. I've had, honest to God, punch card users here on the show,
yeah.
And no.
So my first software were on punch cards. I remember taking the book home when we first got the book of assignments, and they gave us a rack of 200 cards, a box of 200 cards, and I took the book home, and we had a long weekend. And I devised a system that allowed me to do all the projects in the book.
Wow!
With the box of cards, and because I didn't have enough cards, I figured out what I had to write, and then color coded and number coded all the cards so that you could literally just match the colors and the numbers, put them in order, and it would run all the programs.
Wow!
So after the first weekend, I brought the whole book back, and I said, "I'm done." And I handed it to the teacher, and he said, "Well," then I handed him the box, and he said, "Well, you failed." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because you only needed 35 cards to do the first assignment." I said, "No, I did all of them." He said, "Well, then you failed." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you needed about 300 cards to do all the things." I go, "No, here, this book will explain how to do those." And it took him 3 weeks to mark it. I made like 16 errors in the whole book.
Wow, so, that's pretty good.
So that was my first realization that I really liked computers.
So I never used punch cards, and I've always been a little confused by it. What was being punched out, and how did you punch out the holes?
They were called punch cards, but really what they were doing is you're marking a black dot on numbered circles
like
to create
like
the
standardized tests we would do?
Exactly. They're very similar to that. Okay. And that's how they were done in those machines. So what the machine would do is it would read the black dots on the card and it would create bits for each line. And
I kept on imagining like dangling chads causing bugs because I didn't know, you know. It's not that funny. It could have happened. At least in our country. And so where did you graduate from there? I don't mean school, but from punch cards.
So
was that a particular language you were doing? Or
I think it was just binary. Like we were just doing.
Oh, wow. Just like machine code.
It was just machine code because that's it was punch cards. That's all they understood. It was, is this this or that?
Right.
Actually, I think we were doing bytes because each row had 8.
Oh,
so
right.
You could set the byte. It was just very basic. And when I left, I looked at going to university, but then I heard someone from IBM, I think at the time, had said that there was probably room in Canada for about 15 computer jobs. And I thought, no,
that's how many you still have. Is that right?
And at that time, I thought, well, I don't want to compete for that. So I went a different route and I went completely away from computers until I was about 25.
Yeah. And what was that route, if you want to share it?
I joined the military.
Oh, okay.
So I spent 5 years in the Canadian military and then left the Canadian military and started working in nightclubs and realized that computers were getting personal computers, ATs and
XTs and all those,
286s and stuff like that. So,
and there were more than 15 of them by then, I bet.
And there were more than 15 of them. Yeah, by that time, I was really kind of peed at that guy because I was like, oh, I listened to the wrong person. So I started getting hold of old scrap computers because I didn't have a lot of money. So I got a hold of old scrap computers and started rebuilding them myself and working on, you know, overclocking them and doing all these great things. I remember once setting a 286 to go so fast that it caught fire and burnt my desk. I started off in hardware and fiddling around with hardware, and I got into networking and BBSing and all of that stuff.
And so you remember coprocessors?
Yeah.
Hands, who remembers coprocessors? Boy, the number of those hands are getting less and less every year I'm in this business.
I feel so old. So I got
you can Google it, the rest of you.
So I got into playing around with DOS and beginning parts of Unix and Linux and stuff like that as they came out, and then when Windows 3.0 came out, I think I had Windows 1, I think, at one point.
It existed.
And I think I got hold of a copy of it about the same time Windows 3.1 came as the used cycle tends to go.
Yes, it does.
And then
I had Windows 286, as they called it, because it required a 286 to run.
Yeah.
And I would launch Windows 286, play solitaire, and then close all of Windows so I could go back and get work done.
Because that was all you could
do.
That was literally all I could do with it.
There was
so little available on it. It was like a Windows phone.
I'm glad I didn't say that.
I can say that. I'm just kidding. But at that point, there weren't really a lot of software applications. It was the beginning of the shareware days, which basically seems to have been the ghost that has come back now with, you know, the way apps are marketed.
It's true.
And done. So
everything's now add-in purchases.
It's all cycles, right?
Yeah, it is.
Bell bottoms are coming back again soon.
Oh,
right?
Please don't. Please don't. Some of us had to live through bell bottoms the first time. And piano ties.
Piano ties.
Yeah. I'm hoping that doesn't come back.
Oh, that never comes back.
So you got Windows 3.0, and did that lead to actually doing some programming, or?
I got more interested in the networking side of it and getting computers to sort of work together, and I think NT351 was where I really sort of got into the networking and programming side of it.
You lived through NetWare and maybe even...
Oh, yeah.
What was that...
Novell.
No, before Novell, there was this one that was cheap, so a lot of small businesses could afford it.
Oh, I know. Banyan Vines, yes.
No. It's even smaller than that.
Okay, I remember Banyan Vines. What?
No. It'll come to me after the podcast, I'm sure.
I remember fighting through Netscape and or not Netscape, sorry, NetWare.
Were you actually running cables and doing all that?
Oh, yeah. At one point, I had cables running all through my house. And I remember having...
You don't still?
Oh, I have some.
How many would your wife said you had?
I think at our last count, we have about 113 computers in the house. So.
That does sound about right for you.
So if you count
that way, is that how you actually programmed 40 apps at once? You just had 40 different computers with Visual Studio open?
The interesting thing is that when I got into programming, the first thing that I really realized was it was really hard to test. So I wrote these ghost machines that would test my software for me by literally running every combination of keystroke and mouse click on all the controls. And then I had I had racks of 286s and 386s that I had stacked up to do testing, and they would literally just hammer out these applications to go, this failed, and would mark the time and what command it was sent and everything. I mean, it was really clumsy, and it was really just
brute force. Better then.
There wasn't. Yeah, well, there really was. I couldn't find anything, and nothing I could afford anyway. So. Yeah,
there used to be a. I don't know whether it was in Windows or not. I just remember it being on my box that you could record macros, including mouse movements. And I remember trying to test a VB3 app with it because I'd written this long script, and I had to make sure it was exactly at 5.5 on the corner, so it knew exactly where it was and would run and do all these things. And if I got the output, I got the output. And that's why I never did testing again. I still don't write tests because of that.
Testing is hard. And I mean, if you're doing your testing properly, it's really hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it doesn't matter how much you test, you still throw it. You still hand it to that one guy, and the one guy goes, click. This sucks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't know Windows made I didn't know that a Chinese small fishing village made their own Windows phones, but yeah, they do. And my app failed at it.
Yeah, exactly.
I have one of the early Windows phone apps I wrote was a moon phaser. It was just showing the moon, calculating the moon, just something to do. And I got a call from someone in Romania complaining that it was off by about half a day because I didn't localize it. The moon is, as far as I was concerned, was the moon. And so it only really worked in this hemisphere. It didn't even occur to me that it would be half of a day wrong. Like, yeah. How could half a day really matter? Come on. Yeah, it did. It did.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that when you look at building applications, and you, especially when it's something that does something niche, you're going to find someone who's really good at that niche, much better than you are. And you have to sort of be able to hold up to what they're doing. So yeah, it's really great, though, when you find those people and you can communicate with them, because it creates a lot more knowledge for you, and it gives you a lot different perspective.
Well, in that app, I found this old NASA C code that they had used to calculate the moon phase, because I still don't understand it. It could be completely wrong, because I started running tests that would do it like for 1,000-year increments to see if the predicted ones would be in 1,000 years, because it was the only way I could tell
if there's really any change or shift.
Well, yeah, because I don't understand the code at all, because they're taking all these things into account that, you know, the moon's slowing down, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. They're taking into account that the moon is slowing down and getting further away in their calculations. Yep. And so I'm just trusting on faith that NASA knew what they were doing, right? That I didn't transpose it incorrectly.
Yeah, definitely. I wrote an app for Windows Phone that keeps track of your flights that you've been on.
Oh, nice.
And then I started getting strange emails from people that are, you've forgotten this, because I have a library in the app of like 50,000 airports in it.
Oh, wow.
Who would never know that there's that many airports in the world? And people pop up and go, you forgot my local little. And the thing is some of these airports are tiny, like not much bigger than this section of Microsoft building. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like they're just enough for one little plane to get off the ground. But that's an airport and it's registered. And
it has a three-letter code.
It has a three-letter code. And people, you're missing this airport, or this airport is, you've got it located 7 miles away from where it actually is. Like, this is the information I got from the airport standards. So
I actually saw it was going around Reddit recently, the shortest commercial air flight. It's 37 seconds long. Between two islands.
It literally takes off and lands. It's, like, yeah. It's literally,
it's like 100 feet off the ground.
They don't even, they never get fully in the air. They don't actually, they barely get in the air enough to, I've read about that too. They barely get in the air enough to literally be called a flight. Yes. they're literally almost just a takeoff and landing.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So what was really your first language that you fell in love with that you were like, oh, this is where I want to be writing code? Or are you not that kind of developer? Are you like, code is code and I'm more about, you know, experiences?
Well, I started to really, I wrote code in everything. I mean, it started really young, right?
Sure.
And so, there weren't a lot of real languages. It was basically, you're going to push all of this basic text into a compiler and hope it works. So once the languages started handling some of the stuff that you just found egregious to deal with, like the memory collection
and
you know, all that stuff, I thought, oh, this is so much more efficient because I can actually focus on the actual problem I'm trying to solve instead of all the computer's problems.
It's true.
And so once that happened, I started to like them a lot more. I like C. I like C++. But I was happy to not have to use them after a while and to work on the more managed languages. I got into VB for a while, when Visual Basic came out.
And you're talking about the Visual Basic 3 to 6 range, VB.NET or anything, but VB.
3 to 6 range. And because that was the best there was at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it sped development up considerably. And I like that. I like the idea of not spending all of your time doing the mundane things and the basics, like it's the same reason why I code the way I code is I have a huge library that handles all of the basic stuff that you do, like the reviews and the, you know, getting feedback and the, you know, handling, you know, certain types of functionality savings and getting, you know, IO operations and things like that. I don't ever do those anymore. I just write one line of code that just handles that call code, and that code's been tried and true, and it's a framework I put on top of all of my apps. And so I find it much more useful to be able to concentrate on the user experience and the problem solving that I'm trying to do for that particular use case.
Sure.
And so I really sort of fell in love with VB when it came out, and then I was one of those people that was a VB diehard, and when C# came out, I thought, oh, this is just garbage. It looks too much like JavaScript.
I don't think we have anyone else like that here.
It's too much like JavaScript, and I did JavaScript right at the beginning of JavaScript, so I have a deep hatred for JavaScript.
That's how you get a deep hatred of JavaScript.
That's why there's all these people that are like, oh, JavaScript's awesome. I'm like, JavaScript. Well, I still have, like, I have PTSD from JavaScript. I had to handle JavaScript in Internet Explorer 1, 2, and 3. I'm done with JavaScript. When C# came out, and it sort of looked like JavaScript, but it was curious. It was a little bit like C++. It was a little bit like JavaScript, and so I started poking around it. And then after I got into it, I started to really love it. So it's my preferred language right now. But that makes sense. Definitely the type of person that's not, for me, the device or the technology or the platform. It's the best tool for the job.
Sure, that makes sense.
I'm happy to do things in any different way that needs to be done.
It's interesting because when .NET came out, and it was really more about .NET than C# as a language, because, I mean, C# and VB, .NET came out, and I'd been doing VB. I didn't want to go to .NET because I was one of those guys that you're going to take my pointers away from me, you know, from my cold, dead hand. And
I was like that when I started VB. Like, I was just this is just got to be garbage. There's no way it can be any good.
There's no way it can actually get it, you know. And I had some experience with Java, and early JVMs leaked like a sieve. And so I was like, if I don't have control over this, how can I, you know? And I was in a class with Keith Brown back when he was at Develop Mentor. And I was in the class because Develop Mentor had laid me off right after 2001. They went, but you can take all the classes you want. So I figured I'd take advantage of that. And he did this little lab that you were supposed to do that showed how to allocate memory in .NET. And he showed me it was faster than C++. And my mind just, it was this shift in like a half an hour. I went from, okay, okay, maybe they know more than I do, which of course they do. But at that time, I'm not sure I, you know, I believed it because I was a C++ developer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was the same way. I thought that as soon as you stuck, I'm very much of the mind that as soon as you stick a framework on top of a framework on top of a, because I mean, C++ still lands on top of a framework. So I mean, the more layers you put, the more it's got to suck, right? There's more chances for holes and gaps. But I'm really impressed with what they've done with the managed languages in the last 10 years. I mean, they've done a fantastic job.
I'm more impressed with what they haven't done. So as a C++ guy, the two things that made me crazy were multiple inheritance and type defs, right? The two things that were really hard to just get my head around and to debug. They were both really hard to do. And every time... Okay. If you can.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I'm just glad that they never came in. I was a C# MVP for a little while, and every time there'd be one guy at every summit that would go, "Why don't we have the most?"
Oh, the person in the back
thing
that you always want to throttle. Yeah.
Yeah. I won't name his name, but I think we all know who it is. Because it was those features that made C++, other than memory management, made C++ really difficult, because people had tried to make it so eloquent by using all these really advanced things, and it did make it eloquent until it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And then it made it really hard.
It was fantastic until it crashed, and then it crashed spectacularly.
Spectacularly. Yeah. Yeah. I do miss being able to blue screen apps. Every time I want to get back in that world, I think about trying to join the Skype team, because they're really good at it.
Sorry, I was trying
not
to cough.
Imagine what the Skype crashes while I'm typing. Crashes the video driver. I'm typing. Okay, I'm not going to get down that road. I'm very upset.
I love it when you see that there's been a camera driver, like you go through logs and stuff like that, and you see the camera driver crashed while you were typing a message in Skype, and you're like, why? The camera wasn't even on.
No. No, it's amazing. It's amazing. So you came into the C# world at what place? Were you doing like the WinForms space? Were you doing web?
Yeah, I was
web?
In WinForms. WinForms. I was in WinForms, definitely, at that point. I was in WinForms and also doing ASP. So
ASP or ASP.NET or both?
I did ASP originally.
Yeah.
I think that was sort of where I got dragged into C#, I think.
Sure.
Because there was a lot of ASP, C# ASP.
Conversions.
And so I started doing that, and that was when they started working on the whole web apps concept. Yes. I mean, web development is fantastic, don't get me wrong, but I had such a hard time battling against, you know, everything works fantastic, that's great. Oh, someone updated something and everything's broken. And so it just kept that struggle that drove me kind of nuts. And it was sort of why I started looking other ways of
sure.
where I could go. And that's what got me into app development.
Sure. And let's go back just a little. When you started down the sort of IT road and you were playing with the networking and doing that, was your first job more an IT sort of job?
Yeah, my first job was a network, like just a network admin.
And how did you transition from there to your first programming job?
It's actually really funny. It sort of seems that what I do is I do a job that I start working at a job, and then I start on my own doing the job I want next.
Sure.
And then so I started programming on my own and writing my own stuff and doing my own things and writing my own utilities to help me at work, basically. So I started building different things like that, and then started looking at getting work in the programming stage, because I thought, you know what? I understand the hardware fairly decently, probably much better than a lot of programmers do,
sure.
which I think is really important, is understanding everything from the metal right up. Goes a long way, stores, especially when creating connected systems, writing applications that run across networks or run across the wire or wirelessly, whatever. It goes a long way towards understanding where bottlenecks can land, because a lot of times developers will be sitting basically punching against, you know, a rock, not realizing that there's actually a problem switch.
Right.
And that's why your application's not working properly. So I had an advantage at that point where I was able to analyzed directly from the server all the way back, seeing what the network traffic was. I understood how to do those types of tests and get those types of reports. And it really helped me a long way. It actually helped me to get promoted quickly in jobs because sure. I could walk in and go, oh, well, this is having this problem because of this. So
I almost think that you're, and please don't take this the wrong way, but you're not a sort of a real developer until you've had to analyze a crash dump.
Oh yeah.
Right. I have exactly, to actually yeah. bring in Win debug yeah. and understand what's yeah. going on. Yeah. That's the day that yeah. you, I felt the day it happened to me is the day I felt like I grew up as a developer. I was like, oh, there's the hardware. Yeah. Right. Because yeah. even in Win32, which was pretty deep in my career, but even that was trying to isolate you from a lot of that stuff. And it was only until I went, oh, this is actually because I have, you know, bad memory or because...
When you've got to go back into server logs and crash dumps and all of those
all
things.
All of that and really see...
You can see sort of where things pierce through the abstractions and see sort of where faults and...
And today's more difficult because we have to cross that machine boundary. I mean, crash dump is really what happened to your machine, right? Yeah. And then you get into application logging and mapping it to sort of what's happening on every machine and seeing how it works. And, you know, the microservices sounds like a really good idea until you debug. And then it's famously a difficult problem, yeah, but they're all difficult.
It always bothered me when you would be working on something and something would crash and you'd be able to investigate and you get to a curtain point and then you get no more visibility. You had no idea what went on from there on. That's, to me, was always the big frustration. That would be my big screaming point where I'm like, I got to know what's going on past there.
Well, my favorite story about that, which is I worked for a little company before Y2K that was doing a network discovery. So they'd walk through a network, they'd find all the devices, and then they'd look it up and go, not Y2K compliant, Y2K compliant. And they would basically print you out a report saying, go fix these before the end of the year, basically. They're not around anymore because they were essentially a Y2K company, right? You know, there were a lot of those. And they had a client, they had AT&T in New Jersey, which is a big AT&T. And it would run, this discovery app would run for 2 weeks and crash. And we didn't know why. The problem is it would only crash on a network the size of AT&T in New Jersey. There was no way to actually get enough hardware in to cause this crash. And we were like baffled, like, okay, now what? Now what do we do? It had been a problem for a long time. And we still don't know what went wrong. But all I did was I went to my C++ book and went, these are the 10 things that developers always do wrong. Everybody go through their code and make sure you haven't done it. I mean, that's literally, oh, okay, uninitialized pointer and this and just whatever the top 10 were. And it got past it.
So the interesting thing though,
but again,
that happens.
The feeling of, I don't know what fixed it, right? There were 150 little fixes, but none of them seemed egregious. And like you were saying,
yes, I mean, it's what happens when you program for a long period of time. And that's one of the reasons why I like doing talks and I like doing these getting started things with developers where they've never done any of this stuff before, because it forces me to go back and look at the very basics. And then I go back and I'm sure that how many people in this room have gone back and looked at the very basics of what you're supposed to do and go, oh my God, I haven't done that for so long. I really got to get back to it. And then your code improves and you're like, ah, oh. But it's amazing that we sort of shift away from certain basic, you know, basic things that we should be doing and we don't do them. And then you turn around, you go back and you redo it and it just rejuvenates your code. It also rejuvenates the way you feel about coding.
And I think sometimes, at least for me, it's that I sometimes think I'm smarter than I am, right? Well, I know I'm telling students to do this, but I'm just going to go, it's just a little app. It's not going to matter. It's not going to crash every Windows Phone app out there, right? It did.
Yeah, I've given really up thinking I'm smart.
Really? It was bad. It's amazing because for me, it's often ego. It's not, you know, even time or whatever. It's like, well, it's not that. I don't want to go through the trouble of writing tests or whatever it is, right? It can be really frustrating.
Well, I find that the biggest problem is that we all have sort of two standards for coding, how we code for ourselves and how we code for our work. And I try to make sure that I have one standard for coding, which is, you know, a lot easier now that I work for myself.
Sure.
But
there still is a difference between client code and your code.
The thing is you try to keep your standards the same, like your documentation standards, your testing standards, your basic, like your code cleanliness and maintainability. And it's one of my biggest frustrations when working on contracts with people or working on projects with other people, when I see, you know, something that I know is just not going to be maintainable. And then I'm like, well, we have to fix this. Because if nothing else, it's just going to keep me awake.
Yeah, I hear you. I kind of decided that I would have one standard for coding by releasing the code to my blog, right? Because the blog was always the worst code I ever wrote. But it was just enough to like keep it up. And so this time when I rewrote it, I was like, I'm going to release it because it's the only way it's going to be any good.
Because it's awesome when you release a piece of code and then someone goes, that's crap. Should have done this. And you're like, oh God, you're right. And it doesn't matter how long you've been coding. That happens all the time.
It does. The one guy, and hopefully he's not listening, but he went through and he put in a pull request for it just to remove all the extra usings that the IDE had put in, which is a good idea. It really is.
Especially when you're looking at things like phone and things that are memory restrictive. I mean, those usings at the very least temporarily load up what it doesn't need. And so, yeah, I'm a big stickler for things like that. Removing all your usings, making sure your code, I actually code comment first.
Yeah. That's how
so
I was taught.
I write my code story in green on my screen before I write anything. And I write the whole story of what I'm doing in that class. And then I cut up that story and I write the methods to do it. And so my code is usually really heavily commented.
Nice.
So, which helps because I have a horrible goddamn memory.
And it gets worse when you get older, your memory, by the way. You're very proud of what APIs you remember in your 20s. You're like, oh yeah, I know all the 13 overloads of that thing. And now it's like, I used to rail against IntelliSense until I hit 40. And then I was like, wow, this IntelliSense thing, that's a good idea.
Yeah, railed against IntelliSense until it stopped working properly in the last version of Visual Studio. I'm like, oh my God, I'm lost.
Exactly. Well, this has been really great. I appreciate you doing the show. Sorry, you're a little under the weather.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry for the coughing.
No. We'll make sure those are nice and loud in the tape.
Okay, awesome. Just make sure that we bump those up so that when they're listening.
Well, most people listen to the podcast on their way to work, and so it'll help keep them awake. I feel like I'm saving lives.
Wake up coughs, exactly. You're welcome.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the show, and we'll hear from you soon.
Definitely.
Thanks for listening to the Hello World Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the Hello World Podcast at hwpod.com.